Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life. Because what it takes to write the book you want to write also is what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. It's true. You know, it is. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. My conversation with the wonderful Natasha Dionne is up there now. She is just very inspiring, very funny, great conversation. Check it out. Again, authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the good people at the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn about the PNWA and all their classes and their conference right over at pnwa.org. Yeah. So today, we had an interesting one for today's show. Carol Lawrence, she's done all kinds of stuff. I love people like this. Comedy, acting, playwriting, poetry. She's a novelist now. She's got a book out called Cleopatra's Dagger. It's awesome. But, oh, we had a great conversation. She's an award-winning novelist, poet, composer, and playwright. In addition to Edinburgh Twilight, Edinburgh Dusk, and Edinburgh Midnight in the Ian Holmes mystery series, she has authored novellas, short stories, and poems, many of them translated internationally. She is a two-time Pushcart Prize nominee for poetry and has won the Euphoria Poetry Prize, the Eve of St. Agnes Poetry Award, the Maxim Mazumder Playwriting Prize, the Jerry Jazz Musician Award for Short Fiction, and the Chronogram Literary Fiction Award. Her plays and musicals have been produced in several countries, as well as on NPR. Her physics play, Strings, nominated for an Innovative Theater Award, was produced at the Kennedy Center. A Hawthorne Dorn Fellow, she is on the faculty of NYU and Gotham Writers Workshops, as well as the Cape Cod Writers Center and San Miguel Writers Conference. And like I said, she's got a new book out called Cleopatra's Dagger. It's awesome. And I'm so glad I get to share our conversation with you now. Enjoy. Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You busy woman. So I'm talking to you a few weeks after the publication of Cleopatra's Dagger, your fourth novel.
It's actually my 15th novel.
Crying out loud. All right.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but.
No.
It is my fourth novel with Thomas and Mercer, okay. Which is an imprint of Amazon.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's your, were the other novels in the suspense genre or were they, what was the, what?
Yeah, they were, well, they were all in the crime genre. My first two were Sherlock Holmes novels that I did My first two were Sherlock Holmes novels. And then I wrote a cozy series for Berkeley Prime Crime. And then I wrote a series for Kensington of contemporary thrillers set in New York City. And then this series.
Well, that's okay. This is interesting because, so you've written a lot of novels, a lot of in the crime.
I completely forgot. Oh my God. I forgot. I wrote two cozies for Crooked Lane, set in England under the pen name Elizabeth Blake. I'm sorry.
No. It is so good. It is so good, Carol, when you can forget about books you've published, that you are at a point in your life where you can forget about something you've just, you have so many that you can forget. So congratulations on that. But what I thought was interesting about this career path of yours is you've done a lot. I mean, you've written a lot of books, but you've written a lot of stuff that aren't books. You've written a lot of poetry, music, theater.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, the combination of poet, crime writer, that is unusual, don't you think? Or is this some kind of bias of mine? But I don't think it is.
It's interesting. I kind of felt the same way myself. And, you know, I started out in literary fiction. I mean, I went to a really conservative school. We didn't just read dead white males. We read dead white British males. And I think there was like one course in American literature, and the rest was like, you know, T.S. Eliot and Shakespeare and, you know, the Augustan poets of the eight, of the eight, you know, and like, oh boy. And it was so dry, and, you know, they didn't care about our creativity. It was all about scholarship and, you know, writing about writing, which was really good training. And so, you know, but I come from a very sort of rigorous academic background. And then when they asked me if I wanted to go to grad school, I was like, hell no.
I am done with this. Okay, wait. So an undergraduate, you're going this very conservative, kind of stuffy academic thing. Okay, but you're learning a lot. You're probably doing well because you can write. But were you always, before you went to college, were you interested in writing? Were you writing poems on your own?
Yeah. When I was a kid, I used to write. I would write what I thought were scathing satires of my parents. And then I would like gather the neighborhood kids together and we would and I'd put on a play. And it would be, you know, or and like when our family went to Canada with another family, I like produced a play.
Wow.
And I would write like these sketches, essentially sketch comedy. And then, you know, all my siblings and cousins would be in them. And then like I produced the show.
So well, you were like, who are those? I'm blanking on Mickey Rooney and what's
her
name?
Let's put on a show. I was totally that kid, and like it didn't really matter. My sister didn't really like being on stage, but I didn't really care. And I was just like, yeah, you're gonna do this sketch.
You identified yourself as creative from a get-go. Not everybody does that.
I don't know. I just like stories, and then I would do cartoons. I had like reams of cartoons of like, you know, cartoon characters like acting out, like I did the Chipmunks and all the cartoons that were on TV. But then I would like invent my own little characters, and I had a whole race of aliens, and they would be in my little cartoons, and I would be like do little stories with them and stuff like that.
Wow. So you're I mean everyone comes to creativity differently. Some people think I'm not, some people discover it later. And it sounds like for you, you just were, and you couldn't even, and it didn't even occur to you. Not, I mean, I was a bit that way myself. I was doing cartoons and music and stories.
Oh, really? You did cartoons too?
Oh, that's yeah. So I was going to be a cartoonist, I thought.
Oh, my God. I was going to work for Disney when I was 5 years old. I was totally convinced that that was going to be my career path. But I was going to be a cartoonist for Walt Disney. That was like my ambition. And I cut pictures of him out in the newspaper because he represented like this creative genius to me at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would like post pictures of him in my scrapbooks.
Well, so that must have been because, you know, the thing is, when I went to college, I knew I wanted to be a writer, a creative, probably writer. You know, I wasn't sure, but that was pretty much that looked like the thing. And I went to college and there was a lot of people writing about writing. And even though I was only 18, 19, I was like, I don't know. This is kind of BS. I'm not sure. Like, this is very different than how I think about something when I read it. You know, when I would read it, I would read it as a potential writer. And it was
so
all
you,
just like,
so you found literary criticism kind of boring and not very instructive.
I didn't understand like what are we talking about here? I mean, to all my academic friends, I'm sorry. It's okay. If you love it, go for it. But I was baffled by it as a creative person. It seemed like kind of like just a mental exercise. What do you think?
Well, I think it is. And I think that, but I think very, very smart people write literary criticism. You know,
what are you, Carol?
What?
And what are you?
Well, I wrote literary criticism as an exercise. I mean, I ended up at Duke University because I couldn't afford my family had always gone to Princeton, but I couldn't afford it. And Duke offered me this big scholarship.
Right.
And I wanted to be on a pretty campus. It was really, the thing that was really important to me was boys and a good looking campus.
And they had both.
Yeah. Good looking boys and good looking campuses. I found out too late. A lot of them were pre-med and kind of jockey and irritating, but I found my little niche on East Campus where all the gays and writers and musicians and crazy people.
Right.
There was a guy who never wore shoes even in the winter. And, and so like that was, I found my people.
Yeah.
But I think that, I didn't know how conservative it was, but I think that, I mean, I agree with you that, like, I think literary criticism can be a real kind of rarefied academic, you know, hyper-intellectual thing, but I'm glad I subjected myself to that. And I went to a school, you know, which is very unenlightened at the time. And they didn't, you know, they didn't care about minorities and they didn't,
and they didn't
care about my creativity so much. I took like one creative writing class in all the 4 years I was there. But I think having to analyze fiction and analyze poetry and analyze, it wasn't a bad way to train the brain, if you know what I mean.
Sure. Well, it gets you thinking, yeah. But you thought enough that when you got out, you're like, I'm not going back for grad school. I'm not going to go get a PhD or whatever.
I knew it by the time I played. It was like a role. I was playing academic, and I even had a little costume I wore when I was writing my senior honors thesis.
I had
I know this sounds really perverse, but I had like a beat up old blue bathrobe and a pair of glasses with no lenses in them because I didn't need glasses. Uh-huh. But I would like, when I was ready to write when I was going to work on my thesis, I put on the old bathrobe and the glasses and I'm like, okay, and I'm an academic now and I'm going to write this little thesis.
Oh my God, you're such a little character.
Well, and then I became an actor when I moved to New York. So I guess it was kind of, you know.
You did theater. So, oh my God. Okay. We're going to have to race through this, but you're so interesting. So you go to New York and you start getting into theater.
Yeah, I did. I made a living doing comedy. I did musicals and plays and stuff like that. But I found in New York and regionally. And I found that kind of tedious.
Uh-huh.
Because you have to keep repeating yourself every night. Yeah. And it's people who don't realize what hard work acting is. God bless actors. I just think actors are amazing. But then I found comedy improv and I actually made a living doing that for a number of years.
Where?
Yeah. I was with two groups. I was with a group called First Amendment, which was the oldest comedy improv group in New York, started by a wonderful old hippie from California, Barbara Contardi. And she was like this great old fashioned lefty. And we performed in a basement in Bond Street, which was now these days, Bond Street's really, really she-she.
Uh-huh.
But in those days, it was so ratty.
Yeah, that's a lot of New York is like that.
We had this wonderful theater and we just performed. And then later I joined a group called Chicago City Limits, which was a spinoff of the Second City.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they actually paid real money. And so I work with them, for a number of years. And that was really fun because I highly recommend, you know, taking an improv class when you're a writer because it frees you up. And I think that, you know, what I liked about it was a great intersection of writing and acting. I didn't have to repeat myself every night and I could make up stories with my friends on the spot. So it was just like, it was the closest thing to play that I've ever done and actually made a living doing.
Wow. I'll tell you, man, I did sketch comedy. My brother and I wrote a show. We did it around for a little bit and I liked it, but the improv comedian is always to me because you are so like, you got to just let go. You got to be tuned in. You can't doubt yourself. I mean, I've not done it, but I can well imagine what is required of you. It seems like just walking a tightrope, but obviously it isn't necessarily. But
well, there are techniques. There are techniques that you learn, and once you really get them under your belt, it really helps center you and helps you push you in the right direction. But I'd been doing that all my life. I mean, I was a clown in school, and I would like. That was fun for me. So it did kind of come naturally to me because I like goofing around and, you know, I guess I was funny. And so, you know, and my friends were funny and it was great hanging around with funny people all day long. And we would, we would go on tour and there would be competitions to like, see who could crack everybody up, you know, more. And I loved that. And it was, you know, it's really fun being with people who are just funny all the time.
Oh, please. It's the best. It's the best. And so you did that, but you know, suspense, crime, not funny, not normally. I mean, sometimes it is, but not normally. So when did you start getting it in your head? You would like to not play with others, just you alone at a keyboard. Like what happened there?
Well, I'd always been writing. I'd always been writing plays and I didn't stop doing that. I never stopped writing during that whole period. And I was lucky enough to get some short stories published in anthologies while I was still doing, theater. And then I got, and I wrote some musicals that had readings. And then I was with a little theater company, wonderful little company called the Lakota Theater Company. And I wrote some plays for them. And, you know, we just did little productions or readings or whatever. And so I was just always like writing different things. I was always writing. And then I think it just, you know, you don't want to really spend your whole life doing comedy improv. And there are some trajectories that you can, you know, you can at you, two of my colleagues auditioned for Saturday Night Live and got really, really close. They got close. And one of them was this is a really terrible story, but she was in the final callback and they came in and they said, you know, we found somebody who can do everything that you can do, only she's 10 years younger. And the person they were talking about was Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Oof. Well,
and which I didn't even know she had made, you know, she had made a brief appearance on SNL. And so, and my friend was very, very talented and super funny. And I kind of went, huh, if that's the comedy world, huh, that's really just, that's so discouraging.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I like writing. Could be quite honest, I'd rather write a play and sit in the theater and have other people act in it.
Interesting. You would.
Because so that's it's really hard work going to the theater every night. Oh my God, I can't even tell you. I
was what?
It's just such hard work.
I am a big proponent of taking the easy path. I think because there are some people who would, you know, there are actors who would agree with you, but they're like, I don't, but it's the best thing, man. It's the best. Yeah, it's hard, but it's the best thing. But I think if you're mostly aware of how hard it is, then maybe it's not the right path for you. Like,
because writing
to some actors, Carol, writing a book is like walking over nails, right?
I mean, I don't think that, I think they're different skills. I don't know that they're, you know, I think actors are amazing. And, you know, having done some of it myself, yep. I just didn't, you know, when you're acting, you get up every day and the entire day is about being ready to go on that night. The whole day has to be fun. You don't want to get sick. You don't want to get a sore throat. You don't want to eat too much. You don't want to eat too little. You don't want to, you know, you're taking
care of yourself. You're like an athlete.
Right. You're an athlete. And that's okay. It was an okay thing to do. But, you know, when you're a writer, you get up when you feel like it. You have coffee for 2 hours if you feel like it. Yeah. And, you know, you set your own schedule. And I guess I got really used to that.
Yeah. So. You know what? I come to like it. I mean, I teach classes and workshops. It's the closest thing to theater in a way, because I have to sort of be on for a couple hours, but in general,
do you teach writing workshops or acting?
Well,
workshops?
It's writing, and my version of a writing workshop is a blend between writing and like self-help, personal growth kind of things. It's a lot of
that's what the Lakota Theater Company it was wonderful. It was like you're acting, but you're also kind of doing therapy. I loved that.
Yeah, writers need a lot of therapy. I think a lot of time, I think this, anyway, I could go on about that, but that's sort of what I focus on. But it's very, but you know, I'm aware, like I got to be on for a couple hours. But so, all right, so you start writing fiction
and by the way, teaching is great that way. Teaching is performing, but you only have to do it like one or two nights a week or whatever. Yeah. And people, you know, your students are really, you know, I also teach, though I haven't taught a live class since COVID started.
I do them online. I'll be doing one.
I teach online too, but I love teaching live and I think it's really, really fun. And I love my students and I love that experience. So yeah.
I'll bet you're great, Carol. You know what? You're entertaining. And you know how important that is? Even in teaching, I think it's critical.
Yeah. I think it really does help. Yeah. And we laugh a lot in class.
Good.
And, you know, a lot of times I have entertaining students. We have a great time together. So.
Ah, you're good at it. Well, okay. So when you start writing books, let's talk about, because you've written so much, we only have so much time, but let's talk about the books. You've gone towards the crime genre. Like, what drew you to that? Why? Because so many things you could write. Why crime?
Money.
Come on, really? You can make money doing
Stuff. It's true. No, it's only partially true. As I said, I come from a literary background, and my first few short stories, I guess you could, I published ones that, you know, you would be called so-called literary fiction.
Sure.
But yeah, I wanted to write something that sells, number one. But to be quite honest, I'm also really, really interested in the criminal mind and human psychology and pathopsychology in particular. And I took a course in criminal psychology at John Jay, and I have a lot of books on the topic. And I had a brother who was a sociopath, and I think that probably got me started on that. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. So I don't want to get into it too deep, but like an actual diagnosed sociopath.
Well, you know, he wasn't diagnosed, but let me just put it this way. He was the first person in history to burn down a house that was a Habitat for Humanity.
Wow. So he was.
And he he was not a good person. And you know, but how he got there is such a long and complicated story. And right. I don't think he was always a sociopath. I think he turned into one. And so right. I think that it's really, I think that that kind of knowing that about my family and knowing that about, you know, human psychology and the possibilities of delving into that. I think that probably was a huge factor, even though as a child, I wasn't aware. You know, a child, you know, he just was like a normal little brother. But as he got older, things got darker and darker. And so I think that probably influenced me greatly.
Well, but I would think in a way, it's helpful in a way that because you saw him go from just a little boy to a grown person who's doing these things. And
right.
you have the thing with the sociopath is the temptation is not to humanize them, to turn them into monsters. And even though he's done these things, how can you not still see him as a person because you knew him as this person?
I do. And that's why in my books, I often have scenes from the point of view of the killer, whoever the killer is.
Right.
Whether the killer is a sociopath or just a kind of a person who's gotten lost. I'm very, very interested in criminal psychology and how people become what they are. And, I was lucky enough to sit. I was lucky enough to, when I was with Kensington Publishing, they were publishing the great John Douglas. I don't know if you know who he is, but
I'm thinking of somebody else.
John Douglas was the model for Jonathan Harris's character in Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs. He was the famous profiler who I don't know if you know the Netflix series Mindhunter, but that's based on his book Mindhunter.
Okay.
And he and Robert Ressler basically invented criminal profiling. They basically started the part of the FBI, which at the time was the BSU, the Behavioral Sciences Unit, at the FBI. So he's just like a legendary profiler.
Wow.
And anyway, if you're into true crime at all, you know who he is. And so I was lucky enough to sit with him at the Edgars one year because we had the same publisher. And it was so funny because people were like coming up to the table and this one woman, you know, she practically, I met her at the cocktail party and she was like, you know, John Douglas is here. And I was like, yeah, and we're sitting at the same table. And she's like, whoa, do you think I could come up and talk to him? And she just like, you know, sort of came up and was like, oh my God, Mr. Douglas, he was like a superstar, you know? I kind of feel that way about those guys, and I'm lucky enough to know a couple of them, and I just think I know one guy, Greg McCrary, who's also a former profiler. He was at Waco when he was with the FBI. He was the one who was trying to, you know, talk them down
really
from going in. Wow. Yeah. Wow. And Greg actually helped me with, he actually gave me advice on one of my novels. I mean, I can't believe he took the time to do this. Wow. So these people, I find these people who investigate crime and specifically the psychology of crime, to me, they're just like, they're the rock stars of my world. You know, right. I think they're amazing.
That's so cool. So you've got to, wow, what an interesting, and for this book, we'll try to get to it. Cleopatra's Dagger, you said it. Now, this is set in 1880s New York, and so it's historical thriller. We've got a female journalist, of which there were probably six in all of America at that time. Who knows, right? So you've got, that's our protagonist. And so you had to set it, you had to go learn about the 1800s. You had to set it, and it's filled with luscious, tiny tidbits and details. And I'm reading it. The writer in me is going, whoa, she did her homework. Boy, oh boy.
I should.
I know you did.
That's one thing. That's one thing that, that my background taught me is how to do research.
Yeah, well, I mean, you did it.
Like, that's what academia is all about, research. Yeah. So I did learn how to do that. Yeah.
Did you like it? Did you have fun, or were you just itching to get to the storytelling?
Both. Absolutely both. That's a really good question. You know, some of my students tell me, oh God, I get so caught up in the research. I have trouble, you know, getting to the writing. And I really appreciate that. And it's when you're writing history, you know, historical fiction, it's sure. such a balance that you have to strike.
Yeah.
But I'm an impatient person in general. So yes, I was impatient, but I also was absolutely blown away by the plethora of amazing material that is available, especially about New York City. I mean, and I love reading nonfiction. I'd rather read nonfiction than anything. And so maybe because I write fiction, you know, it's like a busman's holiday to read. But I just was so impressed with not only the amount of books, but the quality of writing in the books is just stunning. I mean, it's just wonderful. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Well, I got to say, you did a great job. I mean, I was, because again, this is how I read. I was just going, wow, oh, look at that detail. God, look at that. Oh my God, where'd she find that? Goddamn. Wow. So anyway, it's a weird way to read, but I can't help
no,
it.
No, I read like that myself. In fact, I hate it. I'm a really slow reader. And the better a book is, the slower I read it. Because if it's really well written, I'll go over a sentence three or four times, like, that's a great sentence.
Yeah.
Oh, I gotta read it again. And then I'll like ponder it. It's like, you know. Yeah.
I try to tell my students, like, look, start reading, you know, you hopefully it'll just happen naturally that your reading changes as you start writing. I don't see, like, I write music too, and it's like when I really start doing it, I couldn't listen to music quite the same way, you know. I'd be like,
I know, right?
Oh, how'd they do
doesn't
that
it change you it, it changes does. You so much.
Yeah,
it really changes the way you listen to music, and you become very impatient if something is boring.
Yeah.
And if something is really, really good, you just become entranced.
I know. And you just hear tricks like, oh, how'd they do that? Oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's working.
And yep. I'm training in theory because I grew up playing the piano.
Yeah.
And then I became a professional singer while I was doing, you know, theater or whatever.
Wow.
But my theory was really weak. So I'm training myself in theory because I have friends who can like just sit and listen in a jazz club and they can listen
please.
To the chord.
I don't understand that.
They can tell me what's going on.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to train myself to, like, if I hear a circle of fifths, I know I'm hearing a circle of fifths.
See, I patted myself on the back just because I was listening to a Dylan song the other day, and I said, I'll bet that's in G, and it was. And I thought, hallelujah. I can barely hear when they're changing keys. I know theory.
It's all about training. It's all about training.
Yeah.
All about doing, you know, that's all. I swear that's all. That's all it's about, because
probably is.
Yeah. And I have a long way to go, but I'm getting better. I'm not as good as my friends who can just go like, oh, I don't know why that was really interesting going to the subdominant with the, you know, with the pedal point of the, you know, the tonic. I'm like, huh.
I know.
And then I go home and I try and repeat that, you know.
Yeah. So we're no doubt losing all that, but you know, look at, I get very few opportunities to geek out over music, so I'm enjoying it with Carol.
So
all right.
Oh, can I just recommend a guy?
Yeah.
Adam Neely. go on the internet. Ah. He is phenomenal. He does music theory and music analysis, and the other day I blew my mind listening to his 7 levels of jazz harmony, and I couldn't even, like, by the time I get to the fourth level, I'm like, my mind is blown already. But check him out. He's absolutely brilliant, and he just, you know, he analyzes music on a theoretical level like nobody I've seen. So
that's
and
awesome.
Of course, I'm sure you know Jacob Collier.
I do, but
yeah,
I mean, I know the name, but
yeah, he's also just, he's quite a genius.
And he's another, right. Well, theory. It's a whole thing, people. It's a rabbit hole you can go down, and it's a deep one.
It's fascinating.
Part math, part math, part art. It's so strange. All right, Carol, listen, you've written a lot. So first of all, if people are interested in you and want to learn more about you and maybe even invite you to their living rooms via Zoom for a book group, if you do that sort of thing, where should they?
Oh, that would be amazing.
You'd be great. You'd be great. They would be so lucky to have you. So where can they go find out about Carol?
Oh, so my website is celawrence.com. So my, so just my first initial and my middle name, Carol Elizabeth. So it's C.E. Lawrence. And, you know, my pen name.
Right.
CELawrence.com. And that has, and then I also have a Facebook. I have a Facebook page. The Facebook page, I think, is also C.E. Lawrence. Right. And if you just Google Carol Lawrence or any of my other, too many pen names, you can find, I'm easy to find on the web.
Excellent. Well, all right. Check it out, people. You will not be disappointed, but I'm not quite through with you, Carol. I have one more question for you, and it's this. Finish this sentence. All the writing you've done in your life, and you've done so much of it, but all the writing you've done has taught you anything. It's taught you what?
That the investigation and the journey is everything. Writing is a journey, and I feel like, obviously life is a journey. But what's great about writing is that it's a journey that has no end. So I feel like if I approach writing as an investigation and a journey, it's kind of everything. And, whether you're writing a musical composition or, a story, it's, you follow it and you follow the journey and you continue the investigation.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Carol, congrats on Cleopatra's Dagger and whatever your next project is. I'm sure you'll be just as fabulous as this one.
Well, thank you so much, and I really appreciate your welcoming, energetic support, and it was great meeting you and talking with you.
Thanks, Carol. It's great having you on. Yeah, the journey, people. You know it, right? You know that. It's about the journey. It's a cliche. We hear it, but it's true. It's really true. And as writers, we can get fixated on the destination. We can. That's not the point. No, it isn't. I want to thank my producer, RJ Jeffries. Thank you as always. And to all of you out there, I want you to just go find something you just love to do and then do it.